economic expansions don't die of old age. They're murdered. And so something comes along and it murders the economy. High oil prices, suffocatingly high interest rates, a pandemic, geopolitical issues like 9/11, or a war like the Iraq-Kuwait war, or something like that. These are the things that murder an economy. So no, I don't think we're going to have a recession. I think we're going to grow a trend. The byproduct of that's going to be inflation. What's going to cause a recession? You know, if something murders the economy. Now,
hello and welcome back to Soar Financially, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the @JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the Soar Financial Group. And of course, your host for this conversation today. And we'll be joined by Jim Bianco of Bianco Research. I've been looking forward to this conversation for the whole week. Really glad it's happening now and really looking forward to having an in-depth discussion with Jim on all the macro matters. As I said to Jim before, like, my biggest challenge will be to pack all the topics of conversation into 45 minutes roughly and get everything covered. We're going to talk bond market, we're going to talk Fed policy, we're going to talk inflation, we're going to talk gold and oil and gas. So lots of ground to cover. Really curious what his thoughts are, and of course, like, where are things trending? Have we seen a recession yet? Are we in a recession? Is it coming? All good questions to ask our guest. And before I switch over, please hit that subscribe button. It helps us tremendously, getting guests like Jim Bianco on the program, and of course helps broaden our reach. Thank you so much. Now, without much further ado, Jim, it is an absolute pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Kai. Looking forward to it.
In preparation of this conversation, Jim, I've learned a new word, polymath. Or Renaissance man, because I was, you know, preparing, like, I've been adding new topics to my cheat sheet here, like, every time. Like, you can cover a lot of ground, and that's why my biggest challenge, as I said in the intro, is going to be to keep this, you know, somewhat compact and tight, because we could probably chat for 2-3 hours covering a whole range of topics here, Jim.
Yeah, I appreciate it, and you know, I guess, like I said, I guess I bullshit better than most, so looking forward to doing some of it here with you.
Looking forward to it, absolutely. It's going to be an absolute blast, Jim. But let's start fairly high level. Let's set the scene. Like, how strong is the economy and how strong are the financial markets right now?
So let's start with the economy. The economy, I think, is stronger than a lot of people think. Economists have a term that they call, you know, potential or trend growth, and that is, what should the economy do if no one's trying to speed it up, you know, the fiscal or the monetary side, or slow it down? And that's not an observable number, but it's a guess by economists. And they think it's about 2-2.5%. We're growing at least that, if not at least more. So the economy is not a soft landing. I've argued it's never been a soft landing. It's not a recession. It's a, you know, sticking with the airplane metaphor, it's a no landing. It just keeps going right now. Is that all good and, you know, all wonderful? Not necessarily, because the byproduct of that is going to be elevated or sticky inflation somewhere at around the 3-4% range, and that we're not going to be returning back to a 2% inflation world. Now, a couple of other things about the economy. We're a capitalist society. At least we attempt to be one. At times I question whether we are, but at least we attempt to be one. And what that means is that as investors who are largely listening to us, our job all day long is to take money away from bad ideas and give it to good ideas. So the natural state of the economy, nobody's doing anything to it, is to grow. So I've often argued, you know, do you think there's going to be a recession? The answer is no. And now let me go look at the data. And the reason I say that is that there shouldn't be a recession any particular year. What causes a recession? I like to quote Rudy Dornbush, who's an economist at the Fed, who famously said, you know, the economy was not, you know, economic expansions don't die of old age. They're murdered. And so something comes along and it murders the economy. High oil prices, suffocatingly high interest rates, a pandemic, geopolitical issues like 9/11, or a war like the Iraq-Kuwait war, or something like that. These are the things that murder an economy. So no, I don't think we're going to have a recession. I think we're going to grow a trend. The byproduct of that's going to be inflation. What's going to cause a recession? You know, if something murders the economy. Now, what could that be? A year ago, I was like a lot of people thinking that the bank failures might have been it, but it turned out it wasn't. 12 hours ago, right before we talked, you know, Israel countered against Iran and markets were on edge. And I thought for a hot second there, maybe that was it. And then that kind of went away 15 minutes later. So these are the kind of things you want to look for to see if about murdering the economy. But short of that, I think that we're going to continue to grow at a strong pace. And the byproduct of that is going to be inflation.
No, fantastic introduction there, Jim. And again, lots to follow up. And the question is, like, or the first question I have, the connection between growing economy and sticky inflation, 3 to 4%, because it seems like the U.S. in particular is propping up its economy artificially by massive deficit spending, over $2 trillion this year alone. The question is, of course, how sustainable is that? And where is that headed?
Right. So as far as sustainable, I'll throw in another line that I've been using a lot, too. And that is, whenever we have a recession or financial crisis, and we had both in 2020, the economy changes. And I always got to caution, change does not mean dystopian. I didn't say it got worse. I said it changed. And one of the things coming out of that 2020 period was higher levels of spending. We're seeing lower savings rate. We're seeing people spend a lot more money than they have in the past. They're spending down their pandemic savings. And the government is doing the same. The deficit to GDP, if you punch in the actual numbers, $2 trillion, but the deficit to GDP is about 6.5%. That's typically what you would see the government spending in the middle of a recession to try to end it, not in year three or four of a recovery, which is what they're doing right now. So all this massive spending that we're seeing by the U.S. consumer and the U.S. government is going to keep powering the economy along. How long will that last? Economic expansions do not die of old age. The entire expansion that we're having right now will be one of higher spending. Something will murder the economy. We will have a recession. And then that will be another altering event where we will change behavior and we'll see how behavior changes coming out of it. Quick word, why are we spending more money? That's a good question. I would guess, and this would be my guess, a couple of things. In the last downturn, when things got ugly, we had massive amounts of personal stimulus. We mailed people checks for thousands of dollars. And I think coming out of that, we had, you know, the scarring of just being the lockdown restarts of the economy. Because it went beyond a health thing. It went to an economic thing. You barred me from going to work, and then you mailed me thousands of dollars. And so I think there's a bit of a YOLO. You only live once. People are, you know, spending money. They're living their life. Well, shouldn't they be saving for a rainy day? No, because that's what the mailbox is for. Because the next rainy day, I expect the government to send me a check. Why? Because they did the last time. Maybe that's misplaced, but there's probably, you know, some of that as well, too. And so that's what I think has been powering this economy along. And the federal government is kind of in the same boat as well, too, that it is spending at astronomical levels relative to what we've seen before. Like I said, the level of deficit spending today is what you would be expecting if we were in the middle of a recession and they were priming the Keynesian pump to try and get us out of it. But instead, we're in year three or four. That's why the economy just won't slow. And that's why inflation is not going back to 2%.
It's an interesting debate. You brought up changes, of course, and we briefly chatted beforehand, so I did get a bit of a sneak peek of your probably upcoming answer here, but I brought up the leading economic indicators, and you mentioned to me that we have to take a different approach at maybe gauging it and maybe looking and forecasting. So I'm going to bring up this chart here, Jim, because it's a six-month growth rate. Still signals headwinds here for growth, and I'm curious, like that red line shows a recession signal. It seems like we're coming up through it from a bottom. And the question is, like, and you might have answered it before, but is a recession really off the table? Because those leading indicators screamed recession before.
Yeah. So let me say a quick word about the index of leading economic indicators. And let me just say it bluntly up front. It doesn't work. And it was last redone in 2012. From 1960 to 2012, the Index of Leading Economic Indicators was a fairly reasonable index to look at as far as predicting the economy. If you saw it contract for 6 or 7 months in a row, you probably were either in recession or about to go into recession. By January of this year, it had contracted 23 consecutive months. The only other times it's done that in the last 60 years was 1975 and 2009. We were in the middle of massive mind-altering recessions by the 23rd consecutive month of decline in the LEI in 1975 and 2009. And then in 2023, in the 23rd month, we were in the seventh quarter in a row of above average growth. So it isn't working. Now, why isn't it working? Because the economy changed in 2020. You know, that shutdown restarted the economy, it changed. Now, I'm fond of using the phrase from George Box, a UK statistician, all models are wrong and some are useful. The LEI is an index of 10 leading economic indicators. It's wrong. It is not working. It stopped working in 2020. It told us that the recession started in mid-2022. It didn't do anything of the sort. We've had very, very strong growth since then. But it's useful. By not working, it's telling us, hey, you know all those indicators that we look at? You know all those relationships we think? They changed in 2020. And if you want one example, remote work, I've been a big proponent of this idea that remote work is the biggest thing we've seen in the labor market in 150 years. And I don't think I'm overstating that. Because in 1886 was the invention of the 8-hour workday, 5-day work week. And what we're seeing with remote work is as big a deal as that was in 1886. And so I think that because things have changed, we can't take a model that was developed in 2020 that was revamped in 2012 and worked for all the previous years before 2012. What we went through in 2020, it isn't working anymore. And we have to start thinking about what is the post-pandemic economy? How does it work? What are its rules? Because it isn't the pre-pandemic economy and it isn't the pre-pandemic rules. And you could start with the idea about remote work being such a mind-altering change to the economy. Again, change is not worse. It's different. A quick word about that. You know, is remote work worse or better? Well, if you're an employee that gets more remote work, you think it's better. If you're a boomer manager, you have to oversee all these employees that are home, you think it's worse. But on balance, it's neither worse or better for the entire economy.
I hope my employees don't watch this, but I'm an elder millennial. It makes me slightly nervous. Okay. No, that is interesting. So I'm curious now, of course, as a follow-up, the logical follow-up question is, Jim, like what kind of indicators would you now throw into the mix here? Office occupancy rates and as an example?
Yeah, no, I think the one that I've been using is, you know, the CASEL systems. In the United States, CASEL is the largest security card system. You know, when you work in a big office, you got to swipe in, open the elevator, or unlock the front door. And they've been showing that around 50% office usage for the last couple of years, meaning that the average person goes into the office about 2.5 days a week. And that is a big change. Now, let me give you an idea of what that means. So there's about 160 million employees in the United States, according to the establishment report by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. About half those jobs, about 80 million people, work in service sector jobs that they can work remotely. Obviously, like a carpenter or a waitress or a policeman or a surgeon, they can't do their job remotely. But the other half can. And if they're doing it to, you know, say 2 days at home and 3 days in the office, what does that mean? Pre-pandemic, I was home Saturday and Sunday. Post-pandemic, I'm home 4 days, Saturday, Sunday, probably Monday, Friday, in the office, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. I've doubled the amount of time I'm at home. My lifestyle's changed. I'm consuming different things in different quantities. I'm requiring different or less or more services than I did 5 years ago. This is a challenge for everybody from retailers all the way on down. What does the post-pandemic consumer need? What does the post-pandemic consumer want? The retailers have really been struggling with this because, you know, you can look at like Target. Target's been very good in their earnings reports talking about when people came back to the stores in 21 and 22, we stocked the shelves. What did we stock the shelves with? The same stuff we put on in the same proportions that we had in the shelves in 2019. And what did we find? We had simultaneous gluts and shortages because people weren't buying stuff in those quantities anymore. They were buying things in different quantities. It took them a good year and a half to figure it out. And we're all in that kind of camp as well, too. This economy has changed. Change is not worse. And that's where I think we're really struggling. And because we can't get that right, I think that supply chains and utilization in the economy is perpetually out of balance until we do figure it out. And that's also contributing to higher, of more friction in the economy and higher levels of inflation.
No, I've seen that. I was recently in Vancouver and the office concourses were deserted. Like, I felt bad. Like, retail was just dying there. So,
right.
Because the people that do go back to the office, they want the amenities and they want the services, but it's not viable for the retailers to offer those anymore. It's,
right. No, I mean, most central business locations are seeing that the retail storefronts are basically abandoned. And it's even getting to the point where it's hard to find a place to go to lunch in some of the retail, in some of the central business districts, because all the fast food places, let alone the nice restaurants, are closed.
No, 100%. I fully agree. I've noticed my own observations just walking through downtown Vancouver. Jim, our conversation leads me to think, like, okay, so how does the Fed, how does Jerome Powell sort of use data in forecasting and predicting what might come? Like, how can he react? Like, no, sorry, they are always reacting. Like, but he mentioned and he almost promised that he wants to forecast, like, maybe to be a step ahead of the economy this time. How would he do that? Like, what kind of indicators should he be looking at, and what do you expect him to do next?
Yeah, so you asked how he's using data, and the answer is poorly. they're getting it wrong. I think the problem that Paul has had, and the problem that a lot of people at the Fed have had, is for 2 years, even earlier this year, Paul has been using these words like the economy is normalizing. It's broadly returning to pre-pandemic levels. And it's like, what's abnormal about the economy? What's it normalizing from and to? And basically returning to pre-pandemic levels. He is like a lot of people on Wall Street, thinking that that thing that happened in 2020 when they all sent us home for a couple months and mailed us checks and then sent us back to work, that's over. That's like history, and everything's going to go back to the way it was in 2019. And I'm kind of harping on this. No, it's not. We're never going back to 2019. That was a different cycle. We're in a new cycle. And there, if you're going to start with the economy's broadly normalizing, it's returning to pre-pandemic levels, you could end the press conference right there, Jay Powell, because everything you say next is going to be wrong, because you're using an errant assumption that this is still the 2019 economy. And I think that this is the mistake that they have. This is why they got tripped up with transitory inflation. They got tripped up with this whole last mile discussion, last mile, when inflation last year hit 3%. Everybody started on this phrase that we're in the last mile to 2%. It's very clear, at least I think we're not. We're not in the last mile to 2%. You tried to use the word bumpy to explain why inflation was not getting back to 2%. And now you finally come out, Jay Powell did last week, and said he has no confidence that we're going to 2%, and they're higher for longer for a long period of time. So I think really what the Fed is the Fed is 800 PhDs with all these sophisticated models. But if you start talking about we're broadly normalizing, all that stuff doesn't matter, because you've started with a bad assumption and you're going to then just, you know, garbage in, garbage out to your models on down the line. So they need to really start thinking about it. Like I argued, this is a post-pandemic economy. Now, maybe my assumptions on what it means is wrong, but I feel very strong that it is a different economy than 2019. How is it different? Why is it different? How would we rework the LEI today so it would actually work well, versus using the 2012 model, which is not working very well? These are the types of things that we need to start thinking about, and they're not. And this is why I think they continually get themselves in trouble over and over again. And I suspect that they will, and that the inflation rate is going to stay sticky, and it's going to be problematic, and they're still not going to be able to get a good handle on it.
Brings me to the question, Jim, like, should we just accept 3% inflation as the new normal? Let's get rid of 2%, because we're in a completely different environment, as you said. Does the 2% discussion still make sense?
I don't think we should accept it, because it has huge political ramifications if we do. Let me cite some statistics from the Federal Reserve's Survey of Consumer Finances. And I'm talking about income levels. The top half of the country, that's in income, The top half of the country owns 94% of all assets. The top 10% of the country in income owns half the assets of the United States. Almost all the homes and almost all the stocks, bonds, 401ks, pensions, you know, LLCs on down the line are owned by the top half of the country. And they've been seeing 3-ish% inflation like everybody else, but they've got a cushion. Zillow says their home price has gone up. Their portfolio has gone up. Some of their investments have done well. Interest rates are higher. They're now getting an interest income off their bond portfolios or their money market funds. So they're doing okay. Bottom half of the country in income. They own 6% of the assets of the country, and they owned 60, or they are burdened with something like 60% of the debt of the country. So that's consumer debt that they're burdened with. So that's been a truism for decades. The rich have no debt and own assets. The poor have no assets and have a lot of debt. It's an unfortunate reality. But what made that tolerable prior to 2019 was that the inflation rate was 2%. So interest rates were low and they would get a raise at their job, you know, the bottom half of the income. And it was about 2.5%. And the inflation rate was about 1.5-2%. So to use a tennis term, they were able to hold serve. So a year from now, they can buy the same things in the same quantities that they're buying now. Without having to make choices. If they want to buy more, hopefully they get a raise, they get a promotion, they get a raise, and then they can expand their net worth. But if you now want to accept 3% for the top half of the country, yeah, that's fine, whatever, 2-3%, I'll just grouse about it, pay it, move on. But you're going to put the bottom half of the country in a very difficult spot because they're probably not going to get a 3% wage increase, and they're going to have to make choices. They're going to have to say, I'm going to go to the store and I would like to buy so much of this and so much of that like I did last month or last year, but I can't buy it because if I buy so much of this or that, I have to buy less of something else because I don't have enough money for this because the prices are outstripping my income. That's why you can have two things be true at the same time, is that one is the top half of the country is 70% of consumer spending. The top two-thirds of the country is 85% of consumer spending. So that's why the economy can be strong or trend growth, if not more. And yet when you ask on a political poll, one person, one vote, what do you think of the president? What do you think? The state of the economy is terrible and the president's approval rating is low. Because in the economy, Jeff Bezos gets 10 million votes because of his wealth. You know, but when it comes to the ballot box, he gets one vote just like somebody in the bottom half. So that's how you can explain those two different things. So if you're going to accept 3% inflation, it's just going to be 3. What are we going to tell the bottom half of the country? By the way, bankrate.com does a survey yearly and it came out last month. They said 56% of the country cannot come up with $1,000 in an emergency. They live paycheck to paycheck. What are we going to tell those 56% if we're going to say, just deal with 3% inflation or 3.5% inflation? I'm sorry your boss is only giving you a 2.5% or 3% raise. That's not going to go over well. So I do think we have to do something about the inflation rate, and it has to, you know, and we just can't give up on it. And last thought for you on this. In 2022, Jay Powell was explaining it pretty much the same way I was explaining it. And the idea back then was, I have to raise rates 75 basis points a meeting, and I'm going to put it in kind of a facetious, funny way. You have to do your patriotic duty by watching the stock market go down and lose money with dignity, because that will kill demand and that will bring inflation down. So be a good citizen and lose money like a man is what he was telling everybody. Well, in 2024, okay, enough of that. You rich guys, you suffered through a bear market already. It's time for you to go up. We need to cut rates, and we need to get 5,500 on the S&P. And I'm sorry, you bottom half people. We did all we can do for you. Just accept 3-4% inflation and move on with your life. That's not going to go over well in the long run. Now, I understand it's hard to bring the inflation rate down, but to say it is now a 3% world would not be a good idea.
Jim, just to challenge you, maybe from my understanding as well, because I briefly looked at wage growth in the U.S. and that's 5.77%. So on paper, it's outstripping inflation. right?
Only in the last year or so it has been. But in total, in cumulative since 2020, the unit labor costs and a lot of the other broader measures have not. That there was a massive bump of inflation in 21, 22, and you know, into early 23, and they were falling way behind. And some of the wage growth numbers are catching up a little bit. Now, maybe they continue to go up at that rate. And, you know, and that 577 sounds like you're talking about the Atlanta Fed number, but the median income number for the unit labor costs is more like around, you know, 4.1 or so, still above the inflation
U.S.
rate.
Bureau of Economic Analysis.
Right. But there are several of them, you know, that have different numbers. But in general, since 2020, wages have not kept pace with inflation. If they did, you wouldn't hear people talking about the number one issue in the country is the economy, and the economy is terrible, and the president's approval rating wouldn't be 40% if wages were keeping pace with inflation.
Leads me to the next question, and you've sort of hinted at it. What's the Fed's next move then? Like, the economy is rallying, GDP is growing, inflation is coming back up 3.4%. Are they going to cut or are they going to raise, Jim?
Well, let's put this in this perspective. The only reason we're talking about rate cuts, there's only one reason that I see we're talking about rate cuts. Jay said he wants to cut rates. That's all. If you were to remove that from the equation and go to your random economist and say, here's an economy, here's the data, here's, you know, its growth, here's its inflation, here's where its interest rates are, here's where its stock market is, here's where its financial conditions are, what do you think the central bank should do? I think almost every economist would say nothing to raise rates. So why are we talking about lowering rates? Because Jay said he wants to lower rates. So I've been of the opinion all year that I started the year thinking that there would be 0 to 2 rate cuts. By February, I was at zero. I'm still at zero on rate cuts for the year, but I'm starting to kind of breach over. Larry Summers is, you know, in the same camp I'm in, that there's probably a 10% chance of a rate hike. 10% means no rate hike. You got to get about 50 in order to say that we're even going to get one rate hike. But if the data continues to stay strong, we beat again on payrolls, we have another miss beat on CPI, you know, earnings numbers come in good, et cetera, that number will continue to go higher. And the possibility of a rate hike is going to grow. Again, I would put it at 10%, meaning there isn't going to be one. But it also means there ain't going to be a rate of cut either. We're going to have to see a real change in the data in order to see anything in terms of other than the Fed holding, because I think they're probably going to hold through the rest of the year. And, you know, if you want a rate cut, okay, let's see some terrible economic numbers. And we haven't seen any. Let's see some misses on inflation. We haven't seen any. If we're going to get a rate hike, let's continue the last 3 months of data into the next 3 months. And I think by, you know, middle of the summer, we'll be talking about rate hikes, probably after the election, because I do believe the Fed's political. But we'll probably, you know, hinting at the idea that there might be more rate hikes.
I'm glad you brought in the election, because I was going to ask you about that as well, the impact of that. And you maybe December, first rate hike, just right after. Is that going to cost
only
him his job?
I think his job's done either way. If Trump wins, he's already pre-announced he's going to fire him. So he's toast if Trump wins. And if Biden wins, my thinking is he's probably going to put Lael Brainard in as Fed chairman, not Jay Powell. So I think he goes either way. As far as the Fed goes, Claudia Sahm, economist who used to be at the Fed, gave me a great line. She said that the Fed is not partisan, but they are political. Not partisan. They don't sit around the table saying, you know, we want Biden or we want Trump. What policy do we have to initiate in order to get Biden to win versus Trump or vice versa? They don't do any of that. But they are political. They do know that the July 31st meeting is between the Republican and Democrat convention. And they know the September 18th meeting is 7 weeks before the election. And they also know that they don't want what the Fed wants is they don't want their name ever uttered during the election. They want to be Homer Simpson fading into the hedges. Don't mention me. Don't look at me until after the election. Cutting rates for the first time in July or September makes them the object of discussion for weeks at end in the middle of a political campaign. And I don't think that they want to do that. So they are political. So I do think, yes, you're right. They'll look at the November 7th meeting, which is the day after the election, and the December meeting, but only if you tell me we've got some misses on payrolls and we've got some misses on inflation. For the last 3 to 6 months, we've had none of that in terms of misses on any of this data. It is continuing to stay strong. But, you know, if we continue to see strong data, there will be no rate cut.
Let's talk about the third head of the horseman here. Let's talk about inflation. And let's get a bit more granular. A, what is driving inflation, of course, and how do you see it developing? Because that will lead sort of, might force, Chairman Powell's hand to a degree. And curious what's flowing into that. And might be a good segue to commodities later on in the discussion here, because I'm hinting at oil and gas prices in particular and how they're pushing up inflation potentially. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on inflation and how it's developing.
So just broad strokes, CPI is about 70% or 65% services and about 30-35% goods. Services are driving all the inflation right now, just to dissect the numbers. So when you break it out between goods and services, goods are actually still in deflation. They're around zero. Energy is still around zero. Food is around zero. And you got like 3.5% from services pushing up the entire index 3.5%. So a lot of what you're seeing in it is services. And that's why Jay Powell invented his famous super core number that he's looking at, which is, you know, core services less housing is what that number is, because what usually drives services inflation is wages. So, you know, as you were talking about with the 5.7% wage number, that's the other problem that you have too, is that usually inflation cannot diverge much from wages. If we're going to continue to give everybody a 5.7% inflation wage hike, then they could pay 5% inflation. You know, the inflation rate doesn't have to equal 5.7. It could be a little bit below it, but it can't be 2% and everybody get a 5% wage, because everybody's going to get too much money and they're going to start bidding on stuff and they're going to push prices up. That's why there's a strong relationship between wages and services inflation. So services is what's continuing to drive it. And I think that that's going to stay sticky, you know, in the long run. Housing is another one. The shelter components are really driving. Now, Wall Street believes that the shelter components are going to start to come down a lot because it uses those year-over-year numbers of Zillow and new tenant indexes and everything else that says that inflation is going to fall. Well, the problem there is that I've looked at it on a cumulative basis. And if you look at cumulatively since 2020, OER, owner's equivalent rent, which is the CPI measure of inflation, is up about 23-24%. But most of the rental indexes are up like 35 or 40% over that period. And I've argued that what that means is that that gap typically there's no gap between the rental indexes and OER. And that gap is going to close by housing inflation staying sticky. Not that it's going to go up. It's just going to come down a lot. It's going to come down a lot slower than everybody thinks. And then the final thing I'll throw in there is goods. Goods inflation is zero to slightly deflationary, but I'm of the opinion, like some others are, that what we're starting to see is an emerging supply chain problem again because of shipping. The Red Sea, you know, being not navigable, having to go around the Cape of Good Hope, the low water levels in the Panama Canal, the disaster with the bridge falling in Baltimore is adding up to. And it's very clear on the IMF PortWatch data that the amount of goods and services being delivered worldwide is at the lowest level. It's at the same level it was when the economy was shut in 2020. And that ultimately, if the economy stays strong and our demand for things, stuff, goods, doesn't change, but the amount of stuff or goods being delivered to ports is lower, then we're going to start seeing goods prices start to move up. And there's some evidence that that's beginning to happen, especially even at the CPI level. We've been seeing, at least in the last month, a surprising jump in the goods levels. Now, that was just 1 month in March, and we'll have to see whether or not that feeds through. Everything I'm talking about here is pointing towards stickier inflation. But Wall Street's very good at, oh no, it's about you know, insurance for new cars, and it's about restaurants, and it's about airline tickets. And they always find these one-offs to say, oh, it's insurance costs have gone up, so therefore it's the one-off and that the inflation rate's down. And those are rounding error numbers that they're looking at. The bigger numbers, services are staying sticky. Housing's not going to come down as fast. And if we continue to see strong growth in the economy and restrictions of supply, you know, goods terminals, you know, containers coming in the shipping ports, we're going to see stickier inflation. And be clear, when I'm saying, you know, sounds like, man, it sounds like Zimbabwe. No, it's like 3.5-4% inflation. And that is actually a big deal, that because that's almost double the rate that the Fed is looking for.
No, phenomenal macro lesson there, Jim. And I think it's time we look at the markets and what the markets are doing. I hinted we're going to talk commodities, but let's start at the high level again. Let's start S&P 500. We just broke through 5,000 points to the downside, and I'm curious what that signals. 5,000 is a nice round number, of course. So, what does that signal to you? Like, what's the state of the market? How fragile is it?
So, you know, the all-time high in the S&P was March 28th. And as I look over at my screen, we're down another 1% today, the day we're talking, that we are now down. We've corrected in 3.5 weeks now, something like 6% on the S&P. So we're more than halfway to that, you know, proverbial 10% correction. 80% of that correction has come in the last week and a half, the last 6 or 7 days. What happened 6 or 7 days ago was the CPI number beat and the 10-year yield went over 4.5%. There was a narrative in the market in the beginning of the year of interest rates don't matter. And I used to joke that there's only two people that think interest rates don't matter. Those that have lost money and those that will lose money are the only ones. They always matter. They always matter forever, all the time. You can argue they always matter, but the current level is fine. That's a valid argument. What happened 6 or 7 days ago was the CPI beat. We won over 4.5% on the 10-year note, and the stock market started going down. And so there you go. I mean, people ask me, when are interest rates going to matter for the stock market? The answer is 4.50 7 days ago, and it's underway right now. And if interest rates keep creeping higher, I think they will, that it's going to be even more problematic for the stock market as we move forward. What was the last 10% correction in the stock market? It was July to October of last year. What also happened in July to October of last year? The 10-year yield went from 3.8 to over 5%. So it's like we're rerunning last year's story all over again. Higher rates are a headwind for the stock market. And I think that they're going to continue to be a headwind.
No, phenomenal there, and I fully agree, although I'm a bit puzzled given the geopolitical circumstances. I know I saw you tweeted about the attack of Israel on Iran and vice versa, of course, and 6-7 days ago, Iran massively saber-rattling and then sent 300 drones across. So is that a coincidence that happened that week as well, that we're down 6.5% or most of that, 6.5% in that time frame since then? Is that I made some notes here. Is that something that murdered the economy per se? Like what you said earlier, is that one of the daggers?
It can be. It definitely can be. It can be because if you look at to use that metaphor, the daggers. What is the most common dagger we've seen in the last 70 years that kills an economy? It's been spiking oil prices. The 70s, all the three recessions, you know, from 69 to 82, we actually had four recessions from 69 to 82. Almost every single one of them was coincident with a massive spike in oil prices. The 73-4 one, we actually had gas lines in the United States. That the Arab oil embargo of the 1970s was so acute. So if this was to be one of those daggers, the presumption is that you're going to produce a giant spike in the price of crude oil, which is going to take gasoline prices up as well. So that is, and the reason I say potentially, yes, energy prices have been moving higher, but they have not been really, spiking on some kind of a supply constraint. The reason they've been moving higher, I think, can be better explained by that the demand for gasoline, the demand for energy is strong because the economy in the U.S. is strong. So interest rates, I think what they're responding to is they're responding to the belief that we're in a 3% inflation world and we're in a stronger, you know, trend, if not above trend growth. You add the two together and you know, that's what you call nominal GDP, real growth plus inflation. And that's been running at, you know, the 5 to 6% range in the United States. All things being equal, where should an interest rate in an economy trade? Should it be at 100% like it is in Venezuela? Should it be at zero like it was recently in Japan? Should it be at 4.5% like it is in the U.S.? What's the nominal GDP growth of that country? In Venezuela, nominal GDP growth is 100% because all of it is inflation. And there's no growth, but they've got, you know, plus 100% inflation. In Japan, they've had deflation. They've had no growth. They've had, you know, very low inflation. So they had zero interest rates. So if our nominal GDP is going to stay strong, our interest rates should head higher. But wait a minute, there's a war and there's just threats of higher oil prices and stuff. Have we ever seen an example of a threat of a war and higher oil prices and interest rates go up? Yeah, March of 2022. Russia invades Ukraine. We start a war. What does the Fed do? It raises rates and they tank the bond market right through the whole thing. And we were worried about higher oil prices. Oil prices went to $110 during that period. We were worried that, you know, grain prices, like, you know, wheat prices went into the teens. We were worried that there was going to be a wheat shortage because of the fields and the in Ukraine. Remember, their blue-orange flag is supposed to be a wheat field over a sunny sky. That's how important wheat is to that country. We were worried about all those higher prices. And what did we do when we were worried about that? And we were worried it might produce a recession. We absolutely imploded the bond market and sent yields soaring. So yeah, if we're going to see strong growth and we're going to see higher commodity prices because of it, say energy prices because of Iran in the Middle East, it should tank the bond market. You know, it should not. The reality is, oh, here's $120 crude oil and here's $5 gasoline. Let's stimulate the hell out of the stock market or stimulate everything by lowering interest rates. We'll get $6 gas then is what we'll wind up doing at that point. It should produce higher interest rates. And that's what I think we're going to probably see.
Interesting. Like, I'm not sure, probably jumping too far down that rabbit hole of oil and gas discussion here is the U.S. could be self-reliant on oil and gas. Like it theoretically produces enough. The question is now, how much of a factor is that in the current price environment? And I had a discussion with Doomberg about 2-3 months ago, I think, exactly about that topic. And he says the reason why oil is not higher, and it was trading about $74-$75 at the time, is that reason. So the question is now, should oil be theoretically at 110 already right now versus the 90 where it is today?
Well, as far as, you know, you could correct my math on this, but as far as, you know, the U.S. being independent about oil and gas, we consume in the U.S. about 20 million barrels a day. The world consumes about 85 or 20 of it. I think that domestically in the U.S., we produce something like 13.5 million a day. So we have a 6.5 million deficit, but you could probably get about 4 of that or so between Mexico and Canada if you want to put them in the same hemisphere with us as well, too. So if you throw in Mexico, U.S., and Canada and the production, we're still in a deficit, but we're pretty close to being energy independent. And we certainly have the ability to be energy independent if we were to relax some of the regulations. The day we're recording, the Biden administration put again more restrictions on drilling in Alaska. If we were to relieve some of those restrictions, we could definitely become energy independent. But I don't think it matters whether or not we're energy independent. Canada is clearly energy independent. They have the same price as everybody else because oil is a worldwide market. Its price is set on the world market, not on the individual market. Canada, it does not see the price of energy or the price of gasoline far lower than everybody else just because they're energy independent. Now, they may be because they tax it less than everybody else. But as far as the raw input goes, it's all set by the world market. And I think it will be continued to set by the world market as well. So I see that, you know, whether or not we're producing enough, and I don't think we are to be energy independent, but it didn't matter. The world energy market is going to stay up, I believe, I wouldn't be surprised if Brent does make a run at $80 or $100 a barrel. Look, that's about 15% away. It's not that far away at this point. And it's not going to be any kind of relief in terms of gasoline prices or in terms of energy prices moving forward.
Now, I was just looking up the gas price here in Canada. I was just recently in Vancouver, and the costs were $2.10 per liter in North Vancouver, and that's Canadian dollars. I was just trying to look up, I think it's what the cost is here in comparison. So let's assume 8 liters, four liters a gallon, that's $5.80. So it's roughly the same.
Right. Yeah. And they tax it more there. You know, they tax it more there. I mean, you'd have to look at the wholesale price, because, you know, the wholesale price for gasoline in Europe is the same as roughly the same for the wholesale price for gasoline in the United States. But then Europe stacks about $6 of taxes on every gallon or 4 liters, you know, because they have different priorities than we do. And that's why, you know, they've got a different, you know, their whole culture is set up on that, which is why they have a whole different public transportation system. Anybody who's ridden a train in Europe and ridden a train in the United States knows that in about 3 seconds, how much different that things are and how much they all drive very small cars there because it's so expensive. And we all drive big SUVs because because we tax it a lot less.
Like, what one of my viewers actually asked, I should do a more European focused episode. Maybe I'll get you on, because as I said, you're a polymath, a Renaissance man. You're good at everything here. We'll talk about Europe maybe in part two of this conversation. But I want to get back to bond yields real quick and how they're developing. And we briefly discussed off camera that bond yields, rising bond yields versus a rising gold price, or bond yields versus gold, is really interesting phenomena right now, because bond yields are rising and the gold price is rallying. How does that fit together?
I don't know. It's really what the answer is. What let me back up. You know, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, if you were to ask me about gold, I would have said it's the single most frustrating asset on the planet. You had a pandemic. You had massive money printing. You had a crisis on your hands, huge deficits. You know, if Peter Schiff had his perfect dream of what would take the price of gold higher, it was 20 and 21. You had it all, and the price did nothing. And then you had a war in the Ukraine, and the price did nothing. And then you had the Gaza-Israel situation, and the price did nothing. And then 6 weeks ago, it took off. You know, so it the set of circumstances that seems to drive gold have been very, very perplexing. What has been driving the price of gold higher over the last 6 weeks? Well, it certainly hasn't been yields, because bond yields going up are competition to gold. Why would I buy gold when I could get a big fat yield in a treasury security? Remember, if you buy a treasury security and it defaults, don't worry. Unless you bought AK-47s and plenty of bullets, your gold's not going to do you any good. Because if the U.S. Treasury goes over the side, it's every man for himself at that point. And there is no financial asset or gold that would save you. So that's why it's a competition to gold, because it's perceived to have the same amount of safety as gold. I think what's been happening, if I had to guess after the fact, I was just looking at a chart of investment flows in the United States, ETF flows. They're not turning higher in the U.S. right now. Where it is coming from is Asia. I think a lot of it is coming from Asia and the Middle East. If I had to guess, I think what's happening is it's very clear, you know, if you talk to Leland Miller, a friend of mine from China Beige Book, I think that the Chinese economy is in a terrible place right now. And I don't think it's getting any better. And I think you got 1.3 billion Chinese looking for a place to store their wealth, because the Chinese yuan and the Chinese stock market certainly isn't it. I think you've also got your typical Indian demand. That's another 1.3 billion people. And you've got chaos in the Middle East. And I think a lot of investors in the Middle East are trying to figure out what they want to do with their wealth. And I think you're getting a lot of buying. You're getting a lot of safe haven buying from gold out of those cohorts. And, you know, if you were to look at the U.S. cohort, what are U.S. ETF investors doing? Oh, they're chasing NVIDIA. They're chasing the Bitcoin ETF. You know, they're chasing the new 4X inverse double levered S&P, you know, and then when they're not doing that, they're doing prop bets on the NBA playoffs. That's what the U.S. investor is doing right now. They're not really that interested in gold, but it is the rest of the world that is. And that is what I think is driving the price of gold higher. Even though you're right, all things being equal, bond yields should be a dissuasion against that, but not for Chinese investors and not for Middle East investors.
Jim, you usually insightful discussion, like, and usually like asking my guests like one last question, and please be advised, it's not financial advice or anything I'm asking you for, of course. It's purely informational because I think it sums up the conversation really well. How would you invest $1 million right now?
That is a good question, and I'll give you a good answer, and I'll give you a self-serving answer. I do manage an ETF, and its symbol is WTBN, the Wisdom Tree Total Return Bianco Fund. It is a fully invested fixed income ETF. Its website is biancoadvisors.com, and my first quarter investor letter is up there on that. So that's where you can find what I'm about to say. So I do it, and how would I invest $1 million? I am been in the bond market defensively for this idea that there's going to be higher interest rates. And that's what we've been doing. And we've been outperforming because of that. But I do think that while I've been on record that bond yields would go to 5 to 5.5, you know, I was saying that when they were under 4. Now that's not that far away. I'd like to say that, look, we're in the 7th inning of this rise in rates, you know, to use a baseball metaphor. So we're like 3/4 of the way through it. I'm probably thinking about moving more towards neutral. And then eventually, if we were to get above 5, and that's only 30 odd basis points, 35 basis points away, that I'd probably be moving long in the bond market. And that's where I think I would probably make my best guess. As I said earlier, if we're going to go to 5% yields, the stock market is going to act like, you know, a smoker trying to run uphill right now, the way that it's been behaving because of these high rates. And so it's not really going to really play that game. You know, if you want to speculate in ultra, you know, volatile assets like Bitcoin and stuff like that, you know, go at it. I think that they're going to have some issues here. Not anything devastating, but they're going to still have to work through some issues. But I think the next big play is probably going to be positioning for a drop in yields after they continue to rise another 30 or 40 basis points.
Isn't the 7th inning usually where they stop serving beer and alcohol at the stadiums?
Yes, it is. And that's why people get unruly when they don't end the game real fast.
Yeah, or they sober up and figure out what is happening. So
actually, to be fair about it, they changed that to the 8th inning just last year because they put a pitch count. I mean, I don't want to get into baseball, but they put a pitch count. They slowed the games down and stuff like that.
Okay, I was at a baseball game a couple of years ago, and I was like, oh, I stood in front of a closed gate. I was like, strange.
Yeah.
Being from Germany, like, that hasn't happened. Like, we don't close the bars or close the gates or anything before the game's over anyway. So,
well, they do that. They do that because they want everybody to sober up before they drive home.
That, and they don't want any fights outside of the stadiums either. So there's right. It's a nice measure of crowd control. Jim, what a wonderful conversation. I truly enjoyed it. Like, where can we follow you? Where can we find more of your work, Jim?
Well, you know, again, you could follow me on Twitter at Bianco Research, at Bianco Research on YouTube, Jim Bianco on LinkedIn. My research website is biancoresearch.com, and that aforementioned advisor website, biancoadvisors.com, gives you detail about the ETF WTBN.
Phenomenal, Jim. So appreciative of your time. Tremendously appreciated. Glad we could make it happen. As a definitely a highlight of my week. It's Friday night here now, and this is the last one. So save the best.
All right. Well, it ain't the 7th inning. It isn't the 7th inning there. So go crack open a beer on Friday night.
I was going to open. It's like I told my wife already, I need a glass of red wine tonight. So that's going to happen. Jim, thank you so much for your time. Everybody else, thank you so much for tuning in here to Soar Financially. As I said at the beginning, super appreciative of your support. Thank you so much for subscribing if you haven't done so, because the statistics tell us 75% of you watching are not subscribed to the channel. Let's change that. We really appreciate it. It helps us invite guests like Jim Bianco onto the channel. It helps us broaden the reach and be more attractive for guests like Jim to come on the program, of course. And furthermore, this is for you. This is supposed to be informational and educational. Let us know. Did we ask the right questions? Is this constructive? Or for you, leave some constructive feedback is what I meant to say. And it's Friday night. I'm done. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back with lots more here on Soar Financially.